This is Macro Voices, the free weekly financial podcast targeting professional finance, high net worth individuals, family offices, and other sophisticated investors. Macro Voices is all about the brightest minds in the world of finance and macroeconomics telling it like it is, bullish or bearish, no holds barred. Now, here are your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Serezna.
Macro Voices, episode 377, was produced on May 25th, 2023. I'm Eric Townsend. This episode of Macro Voices was made possible by Respect Energy, a leading European trader of renewable energy and a one-stop shop for all green energy investors. Tresis chief economist Daniel Lacaille returns as this week's feature interview guest. Daniel says we're on the road to stagflation, but there will be some bumps and twists in the road before we get there. We'll discuss the European macroeconomic situation, where markets and the economy are headed in the second half of 2023, China and Taiwan, the emergent BRICS currency system, and much more.
And I am Patrick Serezna with the Macro Scoreboard Week Over Week as of the close of Wednesday, May 25th, 2023. The S&P 500 was down 108 basis points, closing at 41.26. We'll take a closer look at that chart and the key technical levels to watch in the post-game segment. The US dollar index up 99 basis points to 103.88. The dollar continues to strengthen off of those lows. The July WTI crude oil contract up 207 basis points to 74.34. We will look at that chart, and Eric will have the EIA inventory data in the post-game segment. Gold down 101 basis points to 1965. Copper down 507 basis points to 356. Dr. Copper continues to show short-term weakness. Uranium up 84 basis points to 54.20, continues to hold the breakout and press to new highs of the year. The U.S. 10-year Treasury yield up 18 basis points, closing at 3.75. The key news to watch this week is the Friday Core PCE Price Index, and next week we have the consumer confidence numbers, the ISM manufacturing numbers, and the much-anticipated jobs numbers. This week's feature interview guest is Tresis chief economist, Daniel Lacaille. Eric, why did we get Daniel back on the show this week?
Well, first of all, Daniel is a listener favorite, but the reason we wanted to get him on this week is because he's based in Europe and has a strong European background. We felt that his perspective on the impacts of the Ukraine conflict, the European energy outlook, and the general European macro landscape were particularly relevant right now, so we wanted to get an update.
Well, Eric's interview with Daniel Lacaille is coming up as Macro Voices continues right after this message from our sponsor.
If you invest to bring about a world powered by green energy, you should meet Respect Energy, a leading European trader of renewable energy that serves as a one-stop shop for green energy investors in Europe. Respect Energy brings together independent power producers, accredited and institutional investors holding assets in renewables, or undertaking investments in new green energy production, such as wind and solar photovoltaic power plants. More than 600 institutional and accredited investors have already entrusted Respect Energy with the sale of their electricity production, portfolio management, O&M services, EPC, and project development. If you want to invest in green energy in Europe with the help of a trusted partner, contact Respect Energy today and ask for a tailor-made solution. For more information, visit respect.energy.
And now, with this week's special guest, here's your host, Eric Townsend.
Joining me now is Tresis chief economist and fund manager, Daniel Lacaille. Daniel, it is great to get you back on the show. It's been way too long. And of course, what's on everybody's mind, and particularly when your name is mentioned, is the macro outlook for Europe. We had pretty good perspective on the European story from some of our guests through last fall. Everybody knows about the energy crisis in Europe, but it seems like we made it through the winter. Are we out of the woods? Are we headed for more trouble? What do you see on the horizon? And what's the situation look like in Europe?
Thank you so much, Eric. Thanks for inviting me. And I think you've summed it very well. On the one hand, We have survived the winter thanks to very mild temperatures. And also because rate hikes have had a very significant impact on commodity prices. So the combination of lower consumption of natural gas and at the same time lower prices has certainly helped the European Union economy. The Eurozone economy, though, remains very weak. We have had the latest PMI figures show that the manufacturing sector is in its 35th month of contraction. And overall, GDP is slightly better because of lower imports, certainly, because of higher government consumption, which is certainly not a positive in my book because it comes fundamentally from higher debt, and because the services sector remains relatively strong thanks to the tourist season and the amount of spending from the savings that were accumulated during the COVID crisis. But those savings are being consumed, are almost consumed. Citizens all over the European Union are feeling the pinch of elevated and persistent core inflation and overall inflation. And the impact of rate hikes is certainly going to have a significant dent on the economy for a very simple reason. In the United States, the real economy is mostly financed through the private sector, not through the banking system. About 15% of the U.S. real economy is financed through the banking channel, according to the IMF. In the European Union, it's 80% of the economy that is financed through the banking channel, through direct banking lending. And we are seeing, for example, in the latest figures from the ECB, that lending is more challenging, that credit conditions are tightening very, very fast. So the combination of a situation that has been aided by or helped by weaker commodity prices and lower consumption may come back to bite in winter of this year, because the European Union hasn't done anything significant to reduce its energy or to improve the energy crisis.
Daniel, let's move on to commodities and the signal that they're giving us, because frankly, the message is a little bit distorted in my view right now. On one hand, boy, if you look at this energy transition and where we're headed, the demand for copper is going to be off the charts. But oh, wait a minute, look at the chart, speaking of charts, and it's not off the charts, it's actually down. And you look at crude oil, and you know, people will tell me, Eric, you were saying we were going to have this big run-up in crude oil when China came back online and supply disruptions, and you know what? None of it happened. The price went down, not up. You got it completely wrong. And I say, yeah, you know what? You're right. I got it completely wrong on flat price, but look at the term structure. It didn't flip into contango. We got a month or two of contango at the very front of the WTI curve, but the rest of it is in structural backwardation at a time where, you know, at least the retail market's all talking about the weakness of crude oil prices. These things don't jibe with each other. What's going on?
I think that what is going on in the commodity spectrum is the impact of rate hikes and the monetary contraction. Very few people look at the monetary aggregates when analyzing the price signals for commodities. But if you think about it, the moment that the Federal Reserve started to hike rates and to reduce the amount of money in the system, immediately all commodities that were affected by supply disruptions, the Ukrainian war, and all these different important aspects, all of them started to retrace and come back down. No, it is true that the Chinese recovery has been weaker than initially anticipated, but weaker relative to expectations, not weak in terms of marginal demand. So the demand and supply picture of commodities, as you're very well mentioned in the case of crude oil, is extremely tight. Demand is rising, and supply is very, very tight. added to the fact that we have seen a supply cut from OPEC. That is undeniable. And the long-term picture is compounded by a situation in terms of investment that is extremely concerning, because the investment required in order to keep the supply robustly is not there. There's about $600 billion of underinvestment in the oil and gas sector. No? So what we need to look at is the monetary situation. And the monetary situation is what is affecting commodities right now, is that rate hikes plus monetary contraction means that taking long positions in crude oil, financing margin calls, financing storage and vessels is significantly more expensive. Therefore, prices have come down. But as you have mentioned correctly, the curve remains in backwardation. It's not in contango. So the long-term picture, the fundamental picture for energy commodities and for copper as well, you were mentioning industrial commodities because of this massive increase in investment required for energy transition, is the supply-demand picture is certainly bullish. But we need to pay attention to the monetary factor, because if the Fed continues to hike rates as they're threatening to do, and monetary contraction starts to really go deeper into the real economy, it is certainly going to affect the spot prices that we see every day in our screens. So I think that it's a very interesting picture. On the one hand, a supply-demand situation that is undeniably bullish, and on the monetary side, a very, very important impact from the decisions of the Federal Reserve. Ultimately, commodities are priced in U.S. dollars, and if monetary contraction starts to take hold, and we see a significant reduction in money supply like the one that we have seen so far in the year, think about it, the reduction in money supply compared to the decline in the spot price of WTI are almost equally correlated.
Daniel, before we leave this energy topic, I want to come back to the outlook for European energy security, particularly with respect to natural gas, because something that's really surprising me is the number of people, or I'll call it the amount of excess complacency, at least it's complacency in my perspective, where people are saying, wow, whew, we got lucky, we got a weak weather winter, that, or you know, wasn't that bad in terms of cold. We made it. The European energy crisis is over. We survived. It's all set. And I just think, don't these guys understand that winter happens every year? Are we really out of the woods in terms of a European energy crisis?
Certainly not out of the woods. The European energy crisis was closed as if everything had changed, and nothing has changed. But a few things are very concerning in terms of the European energy crisis. The first one is that, unlike last year, if we look at the picture of how much liquefied natural gas can be imported into Europe from the United States in a situation of crisis, it is much tighter. The liquefied natural gas market was ample, and the European Union could use extraordinary resources in a very particular time, which was the Chinese shutdown. But now there's no Chinese shutdown. Now there is a reopening. So the European Union policymakers are thinking about next winter with the perspective of an economy and an energy market that had one of the largest importer of commodities in almost total shutdown. And it's also considering the same weather patterns that we had last year. And those two elements, the Chinese shutdown and a very mild winter, saved the energy market in Europe. But nothing in terms of security of supply has been changed. In fact, Germany is more dependent on coal. We just saw the recent figures of imports of Russian natural gas and products. And they're basically at the same levels as we saw prior to the 2022 crisis in many of the southern European countries like Spain, like Italy, etc. So the energy crisis has been ignored but remains. And all of the energy companies that I speak with in Europe, and this is unanimous, they're all saying the same thing. They're all saying policymakers are counting on the same conditions for 2023 that we had in 22, and they don't exist. Furthermore, policymakers in Europe are not paying attention to summer because it's not just winter. The peak of demand of energy consumption happens in summer when you have a very high demand for air conditioning and there's all the massive traveling because of the holidays, etc. And so most of these energy companies tell me if policymakers are counting on a mild winter, they should also be counting on a very hot summer, which means very high demand for electricity, for natural gas, and for oil. But if policymakers are counting on China to have the same imports as they had in 2022, they're in la-la land. They're in fantasy land. It makes absolutely no sense. So there's a huge problem because at the same time, in that period between winter 2022 and winter 2023, Spain and Germany will have shut down at least three more nuclear terminals. So the dependency on fossil fuels, imported fossil fuels, natural gas, coal, you name it, in periods of low wind and low solar load factor is going to be through the roof. And nobody's paying attention to this. Everybody thinks that they've been incredibly successful and they credit and policymakers credit themselves for the success of this winter's anomaly without paying attention to how challenging the security of supply system is when all of the European countries are on the one hand increasing the exposure to volatile and intermittent energies, obviously solar and wind, and not making anything or not doing the job at securing the peak demand when there is a global player like China that is obviously going to be there at any price when demand peaks. So you're not going to have the same prices and you're certainly not going to have the same availability. And policymakers simply have done nothing. They have just soldiered on building a more volatile and intermittent energy mix that in peak times is massively more dependent on fossil fuels.
I want to go back to your point about energy consumption actually peaking in the summer, which absolutely is supported by the data. But hang on a second. It seems to me that there is a distinction in terms of the ability to, I don't know what you want to call it, sacrifice, compromise, et cetera. You know, in the winter, you don't just decide, well, this is a year of sacrifice, folks. We're going to not heat Europe. You know, people die. If you don't air condition Europe for a summer, well, you certainly compromise the lifestyle of the European people. And frankly, I'm not sure of the benefit of this nation building exercise. But wait a minute, you know, you go without a luxury of air conditioning. Does that really break the economy?
Well, try to go to a shopping mall without air conditioning in Spain, Italy, Portugal, or Greece in the summer. I wouldn't recommend anybody. But we must remember that most of the air conditioning and most of the increase in demand for energy in summer is not coming from households. It's coming from businesses and it's coming from transport, the energy demand part. No, so it's not that easy to it's not that easy to say, oh, we're going to sacrifice ourselves and be, you know, I remember there was a minister of industry in a southern European country that said, we're going to solve it all by making people not use ties. Huh? Don't use a tie and then you won't feel as hot. Well, these kinds of things don't work. Ultimately, transport is what leads energy demand in summer. And air conditioning is fundamentally not household driven. So that's difficult to cut. Because think about this. You may remember that the European Union actually implemented a limit of temperature in businesses to, I don't remember now, 22 degrees or something like that. There was a lot of legislation built on a maximum heating and a minimum temperature in summer and in winter in order to conserve energy. But they forgot about all of that because they didn't need to. Hmm? But if it would have been implemented, we would have seen the consequences. And I'm not sure it's that easy. I don't think people realize how damaging it can be to shed a few degrees up and a few degrees down in your body temperature.
So far, we've been discussing this from a thematic standpoint. Let's come at it from another angle of time horizon. Let's focus specifically on the second half of 2023, because, Daniel, my head is spinning. It's like, wait a minute. Okay, so is inflation is starting to come back up again? So, wait a minute. It looks like a recession coming, so maybe we're about to see a crash. And no, wait. The other signal says inflation is going. Okay, I'm confused. What's the if you just had to lay out as much as you can imagine of what's coming in the second half of 2023, what's the picture?
Well, I think that the picture is one that doesn't necessarily solve everything very quickly, but doesn't break everything rapidly. The picture for inflation is of small decline, but still persistent and elevated levels of core inflation. I think that that is the big risk, because if we look at markets in general, there is way too much optimism about expectations of inflation simply coming down dramatically to 2%, 3% levels with no significant impact on the overall economy. But you cannot have a reduction of inflation to pre-massive increase in money supply of the central bank's levels without a very significant recession. So what I think is most likely is that we will see a mild slowdown in the economy, because central banks do not want to accept that there is no other option of reducing inflation to the levels that we were used to prior to the monstrosity created in 2020. Without a very significant contraction in the economy. We have to think about what is driving GDP growth these days. So if we look at what's driving government consumption, higher debt, which means consuming more units of new currency. What's driving consumption? Also higher debt, because as I said before, the savings have been almost consumed and people are taking more credit to continue to consume. So central banks are basically doing one thing and the opposite at the same time. They're hiking rates because they want to show that they have a commitment to reduce inflation. But on the other hand, at the sign of the slightest problem in the financial world, as we saw with Silicon Valley Bank, as we saw with First Republic, they're injecting liquidity like there's no tomorrow. So the picture for inflation is one of, it's very or relatively easy to bring down inflation from 9% to 5%. As I said before, you just hike rates, commodities come down, and everybody feels relatively more comfortable. The problem is from 5 to 2, and that requires a big contraction in government spending and in consumption. Those two are likely to happen more slowly than what many expected. And therefore, what I think is that the picture that is being created is one that is very uncomfortable for policymakers, which is that of stagflation, which means that inflation, yes, comes down, but remains significantly above what we were used to. And obviously, inflation is annualized and inflation is accumulated. So that means generalized impoverishment. But at the same time, economic growth continues to slow down to uncomfortably low levels. So the picture for the United States, for the Eurozone, is we might escape a recession, but we're not escaping stagnation. And because we're not escaping stagnation, and central banks, despite the messages about tightening, continue to be hugely accommodative, in reality, it is more likely that inflation remains stubbornly high, particularly core inflation. And at the same time, economic growth starts to slow down more significantly than what we have seen so far. So we're painting a negative picture of stagflation because central banks are really not tightening the way that probably would require an economy of the level of exposure to the cycle that we have created in the years of loose monetary policy.
Well, Daniel, if you say that all that's needed is a massive contraction of government spending, I'm sure we can count on our elected officials to do the right thing because they're always responsible. But just in case, why don't we touch on gold and how that fits into the stagflation story? We did actually test new all-time highs in the gold market at 2085. 2085. That lasted all of about 5 minutes, and we're now seeing a correction that's taken us back down almost to the bottom of the price channel, which is conveniently located with a major moving average, the 100-day moving average. That's down at 1940. 1940 is we're recording on Wednesday afternoon. The market's only about $35 higher than that at 1974. Is it time to try to buy that 100-day moving average if we hit it, or are we headed lower? What do you think?
I generally always look at gold relative to the rest of commodities and relative to the global currencies. And if you look at gold relative to emerging market currencies, it is doing phenomenally well, except for Mexico, a couple of emerging market currencies. Gold is doing extremely well as a reserve of value and as real money. Relative to commodities, it is also doing extremely well, exceedingly well compared to energy commodities and industrial commodities. So gold is certainly performing the way it should in an environment of risk of stagflation, like the one that we have described just a few minutes ago. However, it is true that there's always going to be a few periods in which there's volatility because in general, investors are not comfortable with gold. The entire market is more willing to bet on monetary expansion creating big inflation in assets, but no inflation in CPI. And therefore, I think that's why when there's a correction, it is a good moment to build positions on gold. You need to have gold in an environment that, whether you look at it from a short-term perspective or from a mid- to long-term perspective, monetary debasement is a policy, is not a doubt, no? So when you see that the purchasing power of all currencies, to start with the dollar, obviously, but also the ones that are compared with the US dollar, is coming down significantly year after year, I think that it's always good to have gold in the portfolio and take opportunities in which there is a correction to build positions or create positions from those investors that didn't have one. I think that it's a very important asset as well, considering how correlated equities and bonds are. The problem that I see as an investor is that the historical decorrelation between bonds and equities that gave you some level of protection in periods of volatility has disappeared. And as we saw in 2022, if there's a big correction in equities, there's a big correction in bonds, and they don't protect you. And the same happens when the market recovers. So the only really decorrelated asset that investors can build and put in a portfolio to generate that level of protection, to me, is gold.
I agree with you, but there's another aspect of this that you and I have discussed before, although I think it might have been a year or two since we talked about this angle, which is you and I like gold, but I think there's a generational perspective here where younger people are much more interested in cryptocurrency. Bitcoin and other cryptocurrencies used to be sort of all lumped together as an asset class. Seems like Bitcoin's trying to differentiate itself from the other cryptos. Do you still think, or have you ever thought, that Bitcoin essentially competing for market share as a scarcity asset is what has maybe caused gold not to perform as well as some of us had hoped? And what do you think about where it's headed? Is Bitcoin going to succeed at distinguishing itself from other cryptos?
I think that Bitcoin is certainly building a position in which it differentiates itself from other cryptocurrencies, because when we think about it, a currency only becomes money when it is a reserve of value, a unit of measure, and it's a generalized mean of payment. Bitcoin is starting to be those three things, but it's still, as I say, usually it's a startup currency, okay? But it's certainly closer to being money than what other cryptocurrencies have become. So I think that it's sort of creating its own unique space that's worth looking at from the monetary perspective. But one thing that I always find troubling when discussing Bitcoin with people that look at it from an investment perspective is the nugget proposal of saying that because supply is limited, it can only go up. And that is not realistic. There are numerous assets and that are scarce, and where supply is limited and prices come down. We have just discussed, for example, oil, but there's water, for example. I think it's important, therefore, to understand that Bitcoin is moving in two different directions. On the one hand, it's cementing its position as a possible alternative, certainly in the metaverse, but also in other transactions and in other markets, as a unit of measure and as a means of payment, but as an investment that can only go up, and that can only go up exponentially, is something that we have to be extremely prudent. If it cements its price around the 23,000 level, then you can start to see some liquidity coming to the asset. But it continues to perform very, very similarly, unfortunately, I would say uncomfortably correlated to no-profit tech and the riskiest assets. So I would say that Bitcoin is certainly becoming an asset class of its own, but we cannot expect it to reach full level of reserve of value status with the level of volatility that it continues to have. It needs more liquidity. I would certainly not take large positions in Bitcoin, certainly on a long-only basis, maybe on a relative basis against a basket of cryptocurrencies. That would be quite interesting, actually.
You mentioned a correlation between Bitcoin and technology, and it seems to me like that's an important angle, because if I just sort of play this out in my mind, seems to me like what we're headed for is probably a recession. Well, I think the recession's already here, but market recognition of the recession and markets coming down, equity prices coming down. Let's suppose we get into a bit of a market soft patch, a little bit of a panic. And I don't want to use the word crash, but let's say there's a very substantial correction in technology stocks. Now, what that says in my mind is the people who are most astutely capable of understanding cryptocurrency are the same people that invest in tech stocks. So if tech stocks get clobbered and everybody's losing money on their tech stocks, does that mean they have to sell their Bitcoin to cover their margin loans?
Ah, absolutely. Absolutely. But also, if you think of why somebody as an investor decides to make an investment in a no profitability tech stock, it's because it's a very long duration asset with a huge promise and the net present value in a period of improvement of the economy, but relatively low interest rates or negative real rates, then is the net present value is enormous. So ultimately, betting on Bitcoin is very similar as betting on a startup technology company, because Bitcoin is a startup currency. But therefore, if there's a market correction and those four stocks that have generated 100% of the S&P 500 returns in the first 4 months of this year start to correct, and with them, obviously, the beta exposure of those non-profit generating tech stocks leads to them crashing the way that they did in 2022, Bitcoin obviously is going to go down with them. That mentality and that investor mentality and that perception of investing in the future includes understanding the volatility of these stocks. And one needs to think about it from that perspective as well. So if what we have in front of us, instead of rate cuts, which is what the market is discounting, was to be rate hikes, then obviously technology, non-profit tech, and cryptocurrencies, as well as Bitcoin, would be leading the decline. That would be the most logical conclusion, yes.
Let's move back to the macro outlook. And, you know, as I look at this, Daniel, I think about, okay, what are the things that you need to understand to anticipate where the curveballs are going to come from in the market in the next year or so? It seems to me that most roads lead back to China. And I say that from a few different perspectives. One is, you know, if we're going to see the commodity sector recover, it's probably going to be Chinese demand that's pushing it. So, you know, there's a critical relationship there. On the other hand, if I look at the geopolitical outlook and war cycle and so forth, if U.S. and China escalation continues, and particularly if there is a big contentious, you know, battle between U.S. and China over Taiwan, wow, that could, you know, have devastating effects on one hand, yet it could also create supply chain disruptions that just run commodities in either direction, you know, but I don't know how to forecast or analyze any of this because none of the data is really visible. Am I right to think that China is the big wild card here?
It is. I think you're absolutely right. What we are seeing with the reopening of the Chinese economy is a narrative that is being created that the entire slowdown of the Chinese economy was due to the COVID zero policy, and ignoring the very important impact of the burst of the real estate bubble, which continues, and that is affecting demand for industrial commodities, certainly for energy commodities, and reducing the overall growth of the Chinese economy and to a more sustainable level. So I don't have a problem with China growing 1-2 percentage points less. But we see that same narrative and the way in which the market has sort of accepted as a given the situation of the Ukraine crisis, I think that everybody seems to be unwilling to think of the ramifications of a worsening situation of the relationships between the US and China. I think that we have grown to sort of accept that the trade war that was in every headline a few years ago has vanished from investors' concerns, yet it continues. And it not only continues, but it's getting worse. And the ramifications for the overall economy are very, very strong. And the Chinese situation and where China is moving its interests, which are aligning themselves more with emerging economies, with Russia, with India, with Brazil. And at the same time, the worsening the relations with the United States from both sides, obviously, I think that that definitely is going to lead to much slower growth, an increase in protectionism that is obviously negative for trade. And you've mentioned a very important factor, which is supply chain disruptions, disinvestments, or tightness of supply in key commodity areas. So I think that it's something that is extremely important. And actually, when I see the estimates from the IMF or from the different international bodies with improving trends in productivity, in growth, in employment, and in inflation, almost in unison, I see that the risk is rather the opposite, that the risk is that if the tightness of and the worsening of relations between China and the United States continues, which is something that I believe will be so, the trend of productivity, growth, and jobs is going to be weaker for the developed economies, and the trend of inflation on the commodity spectrum is likely to revert and go back to the trend that we saw in 2022, at the beginning of 2022.
Let's talk about a scenario that I'm going to call the Taiwan escalation. And Daniel, I have no idea how specifically it might come about, what the path we might take to get there would be. But let's imagine sometime in the next year that U.S. and China get to a real showdown over Taiwan, where U.S. is saying, look, the entire planet's dependent on Taiwan's semiconductor manufacturing. We, the United States, have to protect the, as the self-appointed police force for the entire planet, we have to protect the supply chains of the entire world. This is the most important thing. China, get out of the way. You know, we're protecting Taiwan. Of course, China says, no, we've always owned Taiwan as part of our country. Those are our semiconductors. We'll sell them to you if and only if we want to. And you've got a stalemate. I think there's a lot of good reasons to think something like that might be coming in the next year or two. If it did, let's kind of do a war game scenario of what are the macroeconomic consequences, knock-on effects, and market effects if a scenario like that were to start to play out?
Well, interestingly enough, in that scenario plays out, the one that gets the losing side, no matter what happens, is the European Union, because it doesn't have the technological leadership. The United States may be able to escape a big crisis because it's a major producer of commodities, and at the same time, it has a technological leadership. The same with China. So both, it's interesting, that scenario, because they may get in a conflict in which the two main players, China and the United States, are obviously negatively impacted. We're talking from that scenario that you're mentioning, Eric, means global recession. But the two main players involved may be the least impacted out of all of the economies that we look at from that scenario. So one thing that I find very concerning about the escalation of tension between China and the United States in the Taiwan situation is that I am completely sure that there's a lot of people in Washington and in Beijing that are thinking the same way as I am, which is that if things get worse, obviously they're going to get affected, but not as affected as the rest of the world. So, because everything is relative, they might even get to a situation that becomes untenable. And that worries me, because obviously it means that somebody out there may be thinking that there is no need to implement diplomacy and negotiations and avoid a really serious conflict. But if that scenario was to play out, it would be very dangerous, certainly.
Well, I vote for diplomacy, but nobody's listening to me. Daniel, let's go back to something else that you said a few minutes ago about the BRICS countries. A prediction that I made in my 2018 book, Beyond Blockchain, was that China and Russia would eventually assert a currency, very likely a digital currency, designed for the purpose of competing with and displacing the US dollar from its perch as the world's global reserve currency. I'm going to make the contention that that is finally playing out exactly as I predicted it. But frankly, I made a big bet on that, so there's confirmation bias there. Am I right that this is playing out and that there's a real threat here? And how real of a threat is it?
I think that obviously they're going to advance that that project. And that's why it is important to bring to the table countries like India and countries like Brazil, because one is a big commodity consumer, the other is a big commodity producer. So it's and they're obviously huge buyers and sellers of dollars as the world reserve. So it's a way of creating the liquidity that that currency would require. My take is that it's quite difficult for whatever resulting currency that comes out from those negotiations, if it does, becomes a contender for the throne of world reserve currency for two very specific reasons. First, two out of four of those countries have capital controls, and you cannot have a world reserve currency with capital controls. Nobody would be willing to accept a currency in which you don't know if you're going to be able to use your funds wherever you want, however you want. The other problem is independent institutions. In reality, the reason why the United States dollar is the world reserve currency is not because the US is particularly better or worse than other economies, but because it has institutions that are truly independent, and therefore legal and investor security is guaranteed. Obviously, those things can change. But right now, with the construct that we have on a geopolitical basis, I think that that currency, if it is created, would probably make a dent on the US dollar in terms of, for example, the commodities that are traded between Russia, India, China, and Brazil, in terms of the investments that those countries make within each other. But very, very difficult to believe that we would decide to change the financial system, for example, and use the, let's call it the brick, no? Instead of the US dollar. Think about this, the euro being the most phenomenally successful monetary experiment in history has not been able to replace the US dollar. In fact, it remains very, very much in a very distant second place to the US dollar in terms of use globally. And if you think about it as well, and you look at the BIS numbers, it is fundamentally because the euro is used within the Eurozone countries. So that ultimately could be the path for this BRIC currency if it happens, is to be sort of a euro in which it is used for the transactions between those countries. But you need a lot more than the strength of four global strong economies to create a world reserve currency, which is that ultimately a fiat currency is all about confidence, no? And confidence is something that is very, very subtle. But it's impossible to create a world reserve currency without independent institutions and certainly with capital controls. So I think that the path is not to become an alternative to the US dollar, but a sort of a much more utilized currency than what the current ratio of utilization of currency relative to GDP dictates. For example, China is about 13-14% of the world's GDP, and its currency is only used in 4% of global transactions. In the case of Russia and India and Brazil, also very much a much lower percentage of utilization of the currency relative to the size of the economy. So maybe align a bit better those ratios, but not necessarily, or at least certainly not in the short term, I don't think I would see a hedge fund deciding to put its liquidity in a BRIC currency in the BRIC financial system because of what I said before, because of capital controls and because of lack of independence of institutions.
Well, Daniel, I can't thank you enough for another terrific interview. But before I let you go, I want to talk a little bit more about your YouTube channel. You now have both a Spanish and English language YouTube channel. A lot of people are familiar with your book, which was Freedom or Equality. For anybody who may not already be aware of that, why don't you give a quick perspective on that? But I want to particularly talk about the YouTube channel. Why are you doing that? What is there? What can people expect to learn when they go and subscribe to your English or Spanish language YouTube channels?
If you subscribe to my English YouTube channel, what I give is mostly information about the economy and markets, very focused on macro monetary policy and market timing. And the channel basically has a couple of videos every week with snippets that anyone can watch, no more than 5-7 minutes, in which I basically give my views on the economic world and obviously on monetary policy and market implications.
Patrick Ceresna, Nick Galarnik, and I will be back as Macro Voices continues right here at macrovoices.com.
Now, back to your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna.
Eric, great interview with Daniel. Now joining us again in the postgame segment is Nick Galarnik. Now let's get to the chart deck. Listeners, you'll find the download link for the postgame chart deck in your research roundup email. If you don't have a research roundup email, it means that you have not yet registered at macrovoices.com. Go to our homepage, macrovoices.com, and click on the red button over Daniel's picture saying, looking for the downloads. All right, Eric, let's cover crude oil, starting with those EIA inventory data.
EIA printed a massive, massive 12.5 million barrel drawdown on crude oil. But that was really a 14.1 million barrel drawdown if you also consider the additional 1.6 million barrels that was pilfered out of the Strategic Petroleum Reserve in the last week. That's right, we're still drawing down the Strategic Petroleum Reserve, now for the 8th week in a row and counting, and at an increasing rate week over week. How's that SPR refill project going, Mr. President? Cushing, Oklahoma, building 1.8 million barrels. Gasoline drawing down 2 million barrels. Distillates drawing down 562,000 barrels. U.S. production ticked back up 100,000 barrels to 12.3 million barrels. Again, 12.3 million barrels per day is the post-COVID peak production level. And it appears to be forming a plateau at that level, which I find very significant. Tape action, obviously up after inventory. That continued for a while. But as I'm speaking now, early Thursday morning before the open, well, it looks like we're drifting back down toward the five-day moving average at 72, spot 77. So is this really going to last? We'll see. We're still above the short-term moving averages for now, so there is hope that we're in a new uptrend. But the big test is still the continuation 100-day moving average at $76 even. As I mentioned in the feature interview, despite the flat price, backwardation indicates that we still have a very tight supply situation. So the reason the market is weak is that despite supply really and truly being in a precariously tight situation, the market just isn't sure if that supply deficiency even matters because recession signals suggest that it could be a long time before we need more supply. More recession signals could easily take prices back down to new lows. But ultimately, when we eventually need to increase supply to meet recovering demand, we won't be able to. And that's when the fireworks will start.
Yeah, Eric, on page 2, we have that chart on crude oil. And this time I put that 200-day moving average on there. But also in that green box, the range between $74 to $80 is what is the high volume node consolidation area. It's the trade range that was defined through from November all the way through to March. And we really, at this stage, bounced in crude oil. And crude oil's obviously been done half decently well in the last 2-3 weeks off of a very oversold condition. But we haven't yet gotten back into that trade range. And often what was previously support acts as overhead resistance. And one of the things that we're watching here is whether or not crude oil rejects here. Like you were suggesting, there could be into a recession, another breakdown that could send crude oil right back down to the bottom end of its ranges, or like retesting even, or heading down to even $60 on the short term. But you're absolutely right. At some point, there's going to be a bullish sequence that's going to come in on crude. But right now, the price action is still very negative, and there's a lot of work for the bulls to do to start to repair this chart. Nonetheless, let's move on to equities. Eric, what are you thinking here?
My formative mental picture for where the forks in the road will lie for the equity market looks like this. First, I think we're in for some volatility as the usual debt ceiling political theater leaves uncertainty in the marketplace. If we get an actual technical default on a U.S. Treasury bill, I think it could bring a dramatic correction lower across all markets, but only until they raise the debt limit and move past the debt ceiling and forget about all this. So sooner or later, they're going to raise the debt ceiling. And when they do, I expect a pop up in the markets, hopefully testing 4309, which is still my number for key resistance, the 61.8% Fibonacci retrace of the overall bear market. In my view, that's a short sell opportunity. Then once the debt ceiling extension exuberance wears off and the market realizes that nothing's actually been solved, that would be the beginning of the next big leg down. Now, obviously, I'm lining up a lot of dominoes there, and things will change, so who knows what's actually going to happen. But for now, that's my best guess of where we're headed.
Yeah, I want to comment on your perspective bit there, but let's get Nick here talking about the levels. Like, what levels are you watching here, bud?
Yeah, Patrick. So right now, the spot on SPX is 41.15. Expected move for the June 16th OPEX is 140 points up or down. So the lower expected move is 39.75. The upper expected move is 42.55. We have a call wall above at 4,300 and a put wall below at 3,900. And the key areas of resistance right now just above us are 4,150, 4,200, then 4,300. And the key areas of support, which we tested out yesterday, are 4,100, then 4,050, and then the key level of 4,000. Now, right now, I'm inclined to think we see a bit of a move higher given that NVIDIA had a strong earnings report. But I do think it's getting a bit frothy up here as well. And we'll look at the cues in a sec. But again, I'm still very, very bullish short term, but bearish longer term, especially as we consider that we have the FOMC meeting coming up in a couple of weeks. We have talks between the White House and McConnell as well coming up, and that should cause some volatility.
Right. So on page four, I have that S&P 500 chart. And the one thing I want to highlight is it's an interesting moment because the primary bull trend is quite intact, even with this 2-day pullback that we had, you know, 100 some odd S&P points. It really hasn't broken any of the primary trends. And more importantly, we have obviously tailwind like the earnings that could from NVIDIA that could create a short-term upswing in this market. But the one interesting thing is that the breadth is simply not there. The market has lost a lot of momentum outside of the NASDAQ and actually seems rather heavy for me. One of the interesting things, Nick, that I'll be watching is whether or not the excitement around NVIDIA gets faded. If we see that that kind of marks a speculative blow off on the short term, and especially if the S&P 500 doesn't make it above 4,200 during that big NASDAQ push, then to me, that would be indications that the market's path of least resistance will finally be some corrective move down. The other big thing to consider is that if there is a debt ceiling resolution, while some people may view that as short-term bullish, that is off at the table. But when the Treasury starts to refill the TGA account and drain liquidity, it might actually spur a corrective cycle in the stock market. So it's going to be a really interesting month of June, especially once we get those job numbers. Nonetheless, let's move on to page five, where we have the NASDAQ QQQ charts. What levels are you watching here?
So spot right now is 336 approximately. We have a call wall above at 340 and a put wall below at 330. The implied move for the June 16th OPEX is plus minus 13 points. Upper expected move is 349 and the lower expected move is 323 approximately. Key resistance right now is just above at 340 and key support just below at 320. And again, with NVIDIA and their earnings report, you know, setting the stock 30% higher, just to put it into perspective here, NVIDIA's market cap increased by more than 1.5 times the entire value of AMD overnight. So it's getting a bit frothy over here. It's very reminiscent of Tesla a couple of years back when we saw the run from, you know, 200 to about 800 or so. And I do think there might be some more upside in the market for sure, but it's getting very frothy and the asymmetry of risk is getting very, very poor the higher we go, as we see that the NASDAQ is, you know, at 1 year highs right now and still pushing higher. Again, you mentioned the breadth. We're seeing, you know, a select few names rising today, for example, AMD, NVIDIA, TSM. And the interesting thing here too is that TSM's earning report is pretty drastically different than what NVIDIA stated for their guidance. So if TSM was lofty in their guidance as NVIDIA was, it would make sense to me. But it seems to me that one of them is perhaps blowing a little bit of smoke here. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, well, you know, to me, the story is really page six, where I have that NASDAQ 100 over the Russell 2000. And when we just see just how dramatically that NASDAQ has been outperforming over the last 3 months. I mean, overall, when you go back from the summer of last year all the way into the first early part of this year, we had the opposite scenario where the NASDAQ was actually leading on the way down and the Russell was actually holding in. And really, the last 2-3 months has just seen this extraordinary divergence, and that continues to only reinforce that breadth issue that we talked about earlier. And while certainly those NVIDIA bulls that, you know, woke up this morning with a big smile on their face are certainly going to be happy, I find it really hard to see how much gas in the tank will be left to keep this trend going. Let's move on though, Nick. On page seven, we have that volatility index. And obviously we were back down to the 16-17 range. Volatility was very low. But as this quick little correction in the last few days happened, that VIX got right back up toward the 20 level. What are you thinking here?
With the upcoming events, you know, the FOMC and the debt ceiling talks coming up and us pushing near 20, we actually peaked above it yesterday, temporarily above 20. I think it's possible we do see a run toward 25 at some point. Again, today, that may not be the case because we're rising on the back of NVIDIA earnings, but I do see that we're going to have some volatility coming up into the June 16th OPEX, and I do foresee that we might be testing out those highs or lows, perhaps in the same time frame. So it's really important to stay on your feet here and not keep too much risk on, because again, as I mentioned prior, especially with reference to tech, the asymmetry of risk is not very good over here, right? Like you look at, for example, NVIDIA as an investment, if you were, you know, buying it right here, what's the upside perhaps, right? Is it $100 more? Is it $50 more? We don't really know, right? But the downside could be much, much higher than that versus if you bought it back in the, you know, in the 150s back in November, December last year, right? So back to the VIX, I do think we're going to see a spike to 25 or so probably in the next couple of weeks. And the catalyst remains to be seen, right? If they do get a deal done early on, that might give us some fuel to the upside, but it also may cause us to go down as well, right? So it's hard to really say. I'm staying kind of neutrally positioned right now, short-term bullish, longer-term bearish, and I think we're going to see some headwinds ahead perhaps. Now on page eight here, we have the US dollar, which has bounced a fair bit the past couple of weeks. What are you guys thinking here?
Well, the dollar is clearly firming up here again this week, but we're still within an established consolidation range between 100 and 105 on the Dixie. My gut is that we're headed back up to retest that 105 level, and that's the moment to watch. When the Dixie hits 105, does it reject there, or does it break out and move higher? Now, that's the moment where you're not going to want to take your eye off the dollar index, but we're not there yet.
You know, Eric, that 105 upper range is exactly what I was thinking here. And what's interesting is that the euro, to me, when this 108 to 107 level was such a critical support area, and the euro continues to demonstrate weakness, like it's about to break through that area. If we see the euro weakening down to 106, 105, it's a given that the dollar index is going to come to that upper boundary range of that 105. But I think the bigger question is that, will it stay range bound? Like, will it reject 105 and come right back to the bottom of the range? Or do, as we move into, let's say, the jobs numbers and into the summer, where potentially some recessionary style numbers can emerge, will we see a risk-off cycle where the U.S. dollar takes flow and punches even back up towards 2022 levels. And that's going to be the puzzle to solve in the coming month or two. Right now, you're absolutely right. 105 is the upper boundary that will probably, on the first go around, cause some overhead resistance. But I think what the dollar does next is going to really be a lot about the economic cycle.
Now, on page 9 here, we have the chart of the gold futures. What are you guys thinking here?
Well, for weeks and weeks, I was saying that we're right at the top of the price channel, pushing those all-time highs. And while I was still bullish that we are going to get a breakout, I thought, boy, we're overdue for a correction here. And I really hope we get one because I wanted a chance to add to my long positions at the bottom of the price channel, not at the top. Well, we finally got that correction, and we're getting very close, as you can see on the chart. We're almost down to it, having come down more than 100 points already. The 100-day moving average and the bottom of the price channel are co-located at 1939, or 1938.8 to be precise, as you can see on the chart there. So we got about 30, 35 points to go to the downside to actually hit the line. Now, from a technical analysis standpoint, that would be your buy opportunity. But assuming that we get to that level, I'm only going to use half the dry powder that I've set aside for buying this dip in gold. I'm going to save the other half just in case we get a much deeper correction, as Tianyang warned us might be coming when we spoke about it last week. Now, as you can see on the chart, if we break down below the 100-day moving average and the bottom of the price channel, the next obvious support level is going to be the 200-day moving average down at 1840 or so. That's fully $130 more downside that's entirely plausible if that channel support breaks. So I'm holding out a little bit of extra dry powder just in case, but I do think there's an add opportunity coming up as we hit that 100-day moving average.
Eric, overall, I totally get the technical levels you're talking about, it, and there's certainly areas to watch. For me, though, in a much bigger picture, I'm obviously very bullish gold going into the next year or two, especially once we have some sort of a monetary easing cycle underway and potentially a U.S. dollar weakening cycle that might come in the year or two ahead. But on the short term, when if we do see broader market turbulence and a broader risk-off cycle, I could still envision gold being incredibly volatile. And while this 1930 area or so is certainly a very key level to watch at the bottom of that channel and moving averages, but a retest of those February and March lows down near 1800 is something that I wouldn't rule out. I think there's going to be some heavy swings both down and up. Overall, I think buying old dips is the right mentality, but it's I think it's going to be a very bumpy ride on the interim, and then we're going to have to wait deeper into the second half of the year for gold to structurally be bullish.
Folks, if you enjoy Patrick's chart decks, you can get them every single day of the week with a free trial of Big Picture Trading. The details are on the last pages of the slide deck, or just go to bigpicturetrading.com. This episode of Macro Voices was made possible by Respect Energy, a leading European trader of renewable energy and a one-stop shop for all green energy investors. Patrick, tell them what they can expect to find in this week's Research Roundup.
On this week's Research Roundup, you're going to find a transcript for today's interview, as well as the chart book we just discussed here in the post game, and a number of links to articles that we found interesting. So you'll find this and so much more in this week's Research Roundup.
Well, that does it for this week's episode. We appreciate all the feedback and support we get from our listeners and are always looking for suggestions on how we can make this program even better. For those of our listeners that write or blog about the markets and would like to share that content with our listeners, send us an email at researchroundup@macrovoices.com and we will consider it for our weekly distributions. If you have not already, follow our main Twitter account @macrovoices for all the most recent updates and releases. You can also follow Eric on Twitter @EricSTownsend. That is Eric spelled with a K, and follow Patrick @PatrickSerezna. On behalf of Eric Townsend, Patrick Serezna, and myself, thanks for listening and see you all next week.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com, the Internet's premier source of online education for traders. Please visit BigPictureTrading.com for more information. Please register your free account at MacroVoices.com. Once registered, you'll receive our free weekly research roundup email containing links to supporting documents from our featured guests and the very best free financial content our volunteer research team could find on the internet each week. You'll also gain access to our free listener discussion forums and research library. And the more registered users we have, the more we'll be able to recruit high-profile feature interview guests for future programs. So please register your free account today at macrovoices.com if you haven't already. You can subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week, free of charge. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer your questions on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors. Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com and by funding from Fourth Turning Capital Management, LLC. For more information, visit MacroVoices.com.